Hello everybody, my name is Anastasia Gaetanou, I'm Greek, I'm from the beautiful city of Thessaloniki in the north of Greece, and I've got a little tongue twister for you today, in Greek of course. Aspri petra ξεξασπρί και απ' τον ήλιο ξεξασπρότερη, which means a white stone is very white and from the sun it gets even whiter. Aspri petra ξεξασπρί και απ' τον ήλιο ξεξασπρότερη. Hope it was fun.
Even in this age of superlatives, it's hard to overstate the historic and artistic importance of the Acropolis. Crowned by the mighty Parthenon, the Acropolis, or High City, rises above the sprawl of modern Athens. It's a lasting testament to ancient Athens' glorious golden age in the 5th century BC. And hiking through the Propylaea Gate, and you ogle at the famous caryatid statues at the Erechtheion, and you admire the perfect proportions of the Parthenon, climbing the Acropolis Hill and rambling through its ruins, you'll either feel hot and tired and confused, or you'll feel like you've just journeyed back in time to the birthplace of Western civilization. It kind of depends on how much you understand what you're looking at. And to better appreciate that, we're joined now from Athens by a guide who's taken countless visiting Americans to that fabled perch, Effie Perperi. Effie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation, Rick.
It was fun to try to introduce the importance of the Acropolis, and I probably mispronounced a few of those Greek words, but the point is, the Acropolis is all about that sacred ritual, isn't it? And we can approach it almost like it's 2,500 years ago.
Well, for us, the Athenians, you know, we take it for granted that it's been there forever. And to be honest, thanks to all the people that get there, we have the opportunity to get this feeling again and again and again, and to thank Pericles for what he's done like 2,500 years ago.
So who is Pericles?
Pericles, he was the general of Athens. He was the one that decided to actually rebuild the Acropolis after the Persian invasion in the 5th century BC. Uh-huh. So he is the reason why I have a job today.
Ah, that's so true. That's the reason we go to Athens, I think.
He made the best investment.
So the big deal for me, the challenge for me, is to understand the pantheatic, what is it called, the pantheatic way?
Panathenaic way. The
Panathenaic way.
Yeah.
And that's, it's of course depicted in the famous marbles from the Parthenon that everybody sees and remembers. I'd like for you to pretend that you and I, we've snuck into the parade. It's 2,400 years ago. It's 400 BC. And we're actually in the parade. They didn't notice it, but I've just got me and my favorite tour guide, and we're wearing a mask or the right kind of robe. What are we going to do? Where are we going to walk? What are we going to smell? What's exciting? What's going on?
First of all, it's a very long hike. It's not just what you see on the Acropolis. Everybody had to meet together at the main gate of Athens, which was called the Dipylon Gate. And then they would go through what we call today the ancient Agora, the ancient city. After they walked for a while, they passed right in front of the Stoa of Attalus, which is a very big and monumental building. That would be the point where the real hike started to the foothills of the Acropolis. Mm-hmm. So whoever wanted to drop off and wanted to stay, they could stay there. Or they had to continue till the end of this hike. Well, along the way, people had to leave their offerings, the sacrifice, a goat or a pig or even a cow, if they could afford it. There would be musicians playing music. And at the end of this hike, you would reach the Parthenon. That was your destination.
So, and you would wind up just like tourists do today. There's sort of a zigzag path up the mountain. And then there's not much is left of the grand entryway. But if you know it's the grand entryway, you can kind of imagine this is the big door to the to Oz, almost, you know, and you walk through that and you're in a, today you have these very shiny polished stones that are baking under the sun. You've got a vast view of all of the city, all the way to the sea. Ahead of you is a commotion of temples. And what's the activity? What is the purpose of the procession? Where are we going and why?
Well, as I said, the last stop is the Parthenon. So the purpose of visiting the Acropolis is to worship goddess Athena, which is the protectors of the city, to make sure that you leave a little something to her. So she takes care of you, she protects you. And they would meet the priests and the priestesses. having all these sacrifices that I've mentioned. And of course, at the end of the day, they would all share the meat of the sacrificed animals.
That's what I've learned. I learned that also in the great Greek temples in Sicily and in southern Italy, which, by the way, if you like Greek temples and you're not able to get to Greece, you've got wonderful Greek ruins in southern Italy.
Best kept.
And you've got this tradition where they would sacrifice all of these animals and then everybody would eat. It'd be a big feast. And I always thought, well, that's a good way to get a good turnout. A lot of people to come to the religious festival is offer a big
it's
kind
a
of
motivation.
A big barbecue.
Yes, it gives them the motivation. Good food, good wine, and it's a meeting point.
Right.
It's a very good opportunity to mingle with people, to get to see people that you haven't seen for a while, and to see and to be seen as well.
In our understanding of temples, we always think a place of worship is like a church or a synagogue or a mosque, and that contains a group of worshipers. People gather together. But in a temple, the public focus is on the exterior, and the religious heavy lifting is inside, but that's only done by the priests. Is that correct?
Yes. Of course, everybody was allowed to go and worship the statue of Athena, but the only one that would be involved in all these sacrifices, it would be authorized people. It would be priests and priestesses. And they were in charge of the religious part.
Yeah.
The people had to join. You know, they had to make sure that they are present.
Sure.
And the rest would be done by the priests.
Okay, but people would gather and they would gaze up at this statue of Athena. I understand she had a shiny tip of her spear that could be seen like 30 miles away out at sea by people in boats.
That's the statue, which was right outside the Parthenon. As soon as when you got up to the Acropolis, you pass from a very monumental gate, very impressive one, which is called the Propylaea. It always gives the false impression that it's a temple and you're, oh, okay, I just made it to the Parthenon. But no, you're not there yet.
Right.
So right after you pass this gate, then you see the statue, which was made out of bronze. And the tip of the spear, the helmet, and the shield were gold-plated, and they were so shiny and polished that could be seen from such a long distance.
Oh, my goodness. It must, especially in the mindset of somebody from 400 BC, this must have just been awe-inspiring. How many years did this procession happen? Was it just a short period of time, or did it go for centuries?
It went on for centuries, from the 5th century BC till about the Roman times. Although
right.
The Romans had adopted the Greek religion of the 12 Olympian gods, but then they started making a lot of fun of it. So it lost its spirit. Mm. It wasn't as religious anymore. So little by little, at the late Roman times, it started declining. And of course, in the early Christian times, they've stopped everything.
And then finally, somebody just declared, that's the end of pagan worship. That was toward the end of the Roman Empire, and then all of the temples were decommissioned as pagan places of worship, and many of them became Christian places of worship. The Parthenon itself has done its time as a Christian church and a Muslim mosque, as well as a pagan temple, right?
Indeed, yes. It's like one temple that represents three different, completely different religions.
Hmm.
Started with what they call paganism, but it was the 12 Olympian gods, the pantheon. And then we have Christianity. And of course, it functioned as a mosque.
And today it's a tourist attraction.
Today it's a tourist attraction, yes.
Wow.
It's a multi-ethnic highlight.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. And today we're joined on the line from Greece by Athens tour guide Effie Papari. And with Effie's help, we're sorting out the wonders of the Acropolis. You know, Effie, when I think of the Acropolis, we often think of the famous metopes and carved panels that are such cultural treasures, and how in about the year 1801, when Greece was run by the Ottomans, it was part of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans gave the English Lord Elgin permission to take home the best of the reliefs. So for over 200 years, the best of the Parthenon has been in London, in the British Museum. And, you know, the English could say, well, the Ottomans said, you can have it, and Lord Elgin took them here. And the English could say they would have been destroyed in other wars, or they would have been melted down, or they would have been dissolved by the acidic air, and we put them in a safe place in London, and we paid for them, and they're ours. But, of course, the Greeks would say, wait a minute, this is part of our heritage, and they belong in Athens. What is the latest on that controversy of the what's called the Elgin marbles?
You know, this is like a never-ending story, which breaks our hearts every time we visit the Acropolis Museum, and we're guiding people and we're talking about this. and people can see the replicas that represent mm-hmm. all these original panels, which are located in the British Museum. It makes people wonder, how come, you know, after so many years that Greece is not occupied anymore by the Ottoman Turks, why London is not returning all that? Well, I have good news, because two places, not England, have decided to return some of the pieces which were stolen years and years ago. The first place was Palermo.
So Palermo in Sicily,
yes.
They have one of the reliefs or one of the panels and they're sending it home?
They sent it already. They sent it for a few months as a loan and mm-hmm. it was supposed to return. And then they said, no, this belongs to you. You should keep it. It's not a big
goodness.
Deal. It's a small piece.
Yeah.
But it was something that made us feel that, okay, somebody is finally understanding our issue here.
Yeah.
Then Vatican responded, because Vatican as well, you know, the state of Vatican, Pope.
Right, yeah.
They had also a few fragments from the Acropolis. So they decided to send us back what they have taken many years ago. How it ended up in Vatican, we have no idea. Mm. So this was a very good opportunity for Greece to start putting more pressure towards the British Museum. You know, with Brexit and the Grexit all these years, we couldn't make a proper conversation.
Right.
But I think this is the beginning.
But now Athens has built an amazing state-of-the-art museum, the Acropolis Museum, which is just at the base of the Acropolis. And it's on the top of the museum, there's the exact size of the floor plan, situated the same way, facing the same direction and so on, where you've rebuilt inside, out of the acidic air, a model of the Parthenon, and all of the existing panels are safely there, and there are empty spots that are quite obviously empty and waiting for London to give back these treasures that are now prepared to receive the bits of the Parthenon from London and to protect it and get rid of London's complaint that it wouldn't be safe to send them back. But there is, in defense of the museum in London, if they give back the Parthenon panels, then every museum around the world, all of the treasures in those museums will probably need to be sent back to their homes, and it'll create a whole avalanche of movement of art and treasures that have long been in the colonial capitals going back to the places they were plundered from, and they don't want that to happen, and it'll be very interesting to see what happens. I do know that in London, they told me it's no longer the Elgin marbles. We're now calling them the Parthenon marbles. Kind mm-hmm. of an admission that the Elgin marbles had so much bad feelings about it that they better change the name.
Yes, you're right. It was a surprise to us, first, that they changed the name of the room. And to be honest, something that has not been heard, they always claimed that we got permission from the Turks at that time, you know, that Lord Elgin was allowed to take them. You know, Turkey responded to them, you know what, we never gave you this permission. So the documents that you have, they're either fake or God knows who made this. And they're like, do not get us involved in this story. We never gave you the permission.
It's such a complicated history in that corner of the Mediterranean, that's for sure. The limestone bluff, known as the Acropolis, has been the heart of Athens and Greek civilization since before recorded time. Effie Pepperi is our guide to sights and history right now on Travel with Rick Steves. You'll find a link to Effie's Facebook page in today's show notes at ricksteves.com/radio. So Effie, when we're thinking about the Acropolis and the remarkable temples there, I just want to take a moment to talk about the sophisticated, organic, amazingly complicated design of the Parthenon implemented in stone 2,400 years ago or so. There's no straight lines in the Parthenon, are they? Everything is designed to kind of be almost organic. Can you explain that?
Well, Pericles, first of all, he assigned two very special architects to design the Acropolis. That was Ictinos and Callicrates. And they knew that there is no perfection in life, in real life, that there is no straight line. And that's why they created the floor of the Parthenon, even the ceiling of the Parthenon that way, to create like an optical illusion, mm-hmm. like to change what we think that it's right, like the floor that it should be perfectly flat. Mm-hmm. Instead, they created a little curve, and that is for many different reasons. It makes the Parthenon look bigger. It makes it look like it's moving, like it's breathing. And when you look at this building from a distance, it looks perfect.
Yeah.
So it fixes what your eye cannot see.
Okay, so the illusion of a, if you look at a straight line from a distance, it sags down. So knowing that they bent the line up a little bit, so each of the straight steps arc up in the middle a little bit so that when you look at it, it overcomes the illusion and it does look straight even though it's not?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I like the fact that also the weight of the stone roof pushes down on the columns and they bulge a little bit as if they're being pushed down. And that's also calculated in there to give it that organic feel.
They call this endesis. That means that you believe that the columns should go from the bottom to the top, like it would be thicker at the bottom, thinner at the top. But about three quarters from the bottom to the top, it occurs a thickness again. So It makes like there is pressure from the roof.
So there's all of that celebration that we don't even fully appreciate, that we enjoy subconsciously as we climb that ancient way. We get to that shiny rock on top of Athens. We can stand on that perch and we can look out. And if I understand correctly, there's 10 million people in Greece, 4 million people in Athens. We can see 4 out of every 10 Greeks from that perch. And that has been the perch that has shined over Athens from deep into ancient times. And there are so many slices of Greek history that happened there. Effie, it's such a delight talking with you. If you could just finish by just illustrating another slice of the story of the Acropolis, and that's back from 1941, and there's a flag that flies over the Acropolis. And I think when Athenians look at that flag, they often think of the heroic resistance martyr that really did something astounding in his fight against the Nazis. What happened in 1941?
So during World War II, when the Germans took over the city, there was a flag flying at the Acropolis, and there was a Greek guard that he was forced by the Germans, by the Nazis, to remove the Greek flag and, of course, to put up the Nazis flag. The first thing he did was to wrap this flag with his body, and he fell off the cliff. He committed suicide because he thought that he is betraying his country. So during that day, the people could see the Nazis flag flying all over the city. And there were two other men, Glezos and Sandas were the names, that decided over the night to climb to the Acropolis under the nose of the Germans and to change one more time the flag, removing the Nazis flag and raising the Greek flag again. So that was the night when the Athenians, they saw that they're not going to give in, that they're going to resist, that this is the beginning of the resistance. So in other countries, you know, they celebrate the end of the war. We are celebrating the beginning of the resistance as far as Athens history, you know, World War II.
Wow. And that is just in living memory of some people even today. And it's a reminder of the importance of the Acropolis for the soul of the Greek people. Effie Pepperi, thank you so much for joining us. And you've inspired me to want to go back to the Acropolis and appreciate it even more. How do we say thank you?
Ευχαριστώ.
Ευχαριστώ.
Παρακαλώ. Thank you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. I'm the executive producer, Tim Tappan. Our associate producers are Kasmira Hall and Donna Bardsley. Website uploads are by Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Quirt. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Find out when other radio stations air Travel with Rick Steves. You can find a list of our affiliates at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.